Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Conspiracy theories, we've all heard them. The moon landing was staged by NASA in a studio. Elvis is alive and well. Area 51 is a government cover-up of the existence of aliens and UFOs. Today we look at the psychology of conspiracy theories, and with us is psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
And social worker Ann Gagan, good morning to you.
Good morning to you all.
So research from the University of Chicago indicates that at least 50% of Americans believe in at least one conspiracy theory. Does that surprise you, that number? Anybody?
I guess we can say it's understandable, especially at this time. There's such a pandemic of conspiracy theories that has infected and continues to infect us. But we'd like to think that we're better than that. And we'll get into this later on, but our brains are awfully faulty. As marvelous as they are, they're very faulty in really deciphering what is, quote, true and what is not. And then, of course, you can always argue what is truth, but
right.
We'll have to get into that today. But so the point is, our brains are faulty. They're built that way. It's a given. And the best we can do is be aware of some of the fault lines.
Yeah. That same research study, it says 19% of Americans believe the U.S. government was behind the 9/11 attacks. 11% of people believe the government is mandating a switch to compact fluorescent light bulbs because the light bulbs make people obedient and easy to control. And we can look at some of these things and go, wow, that's kind of crazy. But then all of a sudden, one will come and go, wait a minute. That might be true, right? So that 50%, maybe it doesn't seem such a large number when you think about some of these conspiracy theories are way out there, but there are some that actually could seem feeable, right?
Oh, they all have a kernel of truth.
The LEDs.
It could be
conspiracy
elaborated. You have to use some critical judgment about the elaboration process.
Yeah. Jonathan, what were you saying?
I was saying, thank God that we've moved on to LED light bulbs. the conspiracy has now been vanquished.
That's the other thing about conspiracy theories. It'll only just morph into something else, related. Then there's a problem with LED lights,
Right. So as we're saying, some of these conspiracy theories can seem completely ridiculous, but Mark, there are some biological and evolutionary facts to consider here. So fill us in.
Right. Yeah, we really need to appreciate these things about our brain, which really come from how the brain was evolved, how it became such a complicated organ. You know, it's 4% of our body weight, but it's 22% of the energy that our body uses. So there's a lot of resource that goes into keeping the brain going. It evolved according to survival. In other words, the things that the characteristics of our brain that we take for granted and are superior to animals all came because they had a survival benefit. They didn't come because they had a truth benefit. They had a accuracy benefit. Those things are really by the wayside. We perceive because somewhere along the line, it was advantageous to have our brain work this way. And there's a lot of shortcuts that our brain takes. First off, you have to appreciate we only perceive and attend to a very small amount of information about the world around us. Small amount of information is processed and becomes memories. But memories are themselves flawed because they're not tape recordings. They're not video recordings. They're recreated in the moment. You pull them together in the moment. And when you do that, you have an update of your memory according to what is important in that moment. Again, survival. What is important right at that moment to know about? Our brain has an amazing capacity to fill in blanks of information when we don't have it. I remember as a kid doing the cartoon business where we would page through a book with our thumbs real quick, and we would see the movement in the figures. And that was, of course, the principle that Disney brought forward. Just amazed by that. But that's the what we're looking at, obviously, is still images, but our brain gives meaning and movement to the flashing cards. The other thing about how the brain evolved is it evolved in a very dangerous environment. I'm talking about before 10,000 years ago, at least. Things were very dangerous. Humans were just a species that could be food for others. So the brain's primary job is to keep you safe. It uses whatever shortcuts are available. So you need to also realize that we're both emotional and rational creatures at the same time, neither one or the other, but a combination. And actually, our default mode of operation is to make decisions unconsciously on very little information that is processed in parts of the brain that evolved in terms of evolution early, primitive parts of the brain, the reptile part of our brain. That then feeds up to our conscious part of our brain, which other animals or other species don't have such a complicated version of. That feeds up already processed and given a tag, if you will, about danger or not danger, about approach or not approach, about reward or punishment. That is already presented to us in a processed way that we have no control over. We can only react to what's presented to our conscious mind. And what we really believe, humans are really excellent at this, we believe in stories. And we tell ourselves a narrative, a story about what is going on in the world. Now, that narrative, that story, is first off based on flawed information because it came through our senses. And also, it's modified by our cognitive biases, our emotional needs that can change things in the interpretation, if you will, that keep us safe. And especially our emotional needs and desires. So all those factors kind of come in together to produce this narrative that is not based on truth. It's not, again, it's not a video recording of what is happening. Take those pieces of evolution, those pieces of biological fact, and combined it with a very strong tendency that we have to overestimate our ability to tell what's true and what's not. We overestimate it. And the fact is we have a greater power for deceiving ourselves. And that is really what happens. And if somebody says that, I'm free of cognitive biases, I'm free of deceiving myself, I know what's going on, they're committing the master bias. That is, by not realizing that they are subject, that everybody is subject to distorting information and making meaning of it that is suitable to your own psychology. The other fact is when an idea comes up or is in the social realm, there's a very strong pressure to identify with that idea according to how others have identified with it. You know, a strong social pressure to conform. Now, taking all of these things together, it's surprising that we got along as well as we have, because we really are limited. If this is the way our brain works, we're going to talk about how conspiracy theories can be so contagious and so influential.
Yeah. Anne.
Well, you know, in taking what Marcus said and thinking about how tribal we were and continue to be, you think about how the tales, the stories, the perceptions were shared around the fire way back when, the stories that ended up morphing into folklore or mythology. And I, jumping ahead to the technology age where we have our little tribes based on who's on our Twitter feed and who's on Facebook, it's a very similar set of circumstances. We only hear, and we'll get to this later, we're only hear what we want to hear that reinforces the tale or the mythology or the conspiracy. And there's usually always a leader, you know, the head of the tribe, the shaman, or the leader who has a greater level of authority because of his prowess or her, generally his prowess. So what he says has a great impact, and then the narrative goes down generationally and generationally in ancient times. But there is, it does seem like that is a similar template that we have now with the way technology isolates us into our own tribes and our own self-perpetuating stories and conspiracies.
Yeah. And as Mark, as you were saying too, and how two people can look at a set of facts, circumstances, whatever, and come away with completely different perspectives or impressions of that. And of course, as we're saying, conspiracy theories abound throughout history, but especially in times of crisis, which we are in now. So fear fuels some of this conception, right? I mean, so talk about the role of fear in this.
Well, fear is the main ingredient, really, I think you can say, you know, humans are unique in that we're the only species that could contemplate our own death. We know we're here temporarily, and we know what death is, and we can communicate about it. Other animals don't or can't. They just don't have the hardware to do that. So with that as a background of just being alive, that's frightening.
Fear is also probably the most powerful force that a leader can employ,
right,
to galvanize and unify people. We saw this, I think probably most of us in the U.S. don't like to look back on this, but it's pretty clear that there was not the evidence that there was claimed to be that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The supposed evidence that this existed was the reason for sending our troops in and declaring war. But lo and behold, there were none. But the fear that was promulgated was the fear that we would all potentially be at risk because of these weapons. We are now today saying goodbye to a president who, whether you like him or you don't like him, objectively is a master at whipping up fear. In his case, it was the immigrants, the Mexicans, the rapists. I mean, it was really very explicit. So living even without the pandemic, living at a time where science is even more difficult to understand than ever before. I mean, you know, people with college educations have difficulty, by and large, I would say, in understanding, you know, what is, you know, radiation and what threat might there be from Wi-Fi systems or telecommunications towers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on. So there's been a perfect storm over these last many years of fear-mongering, genuine difficulty in understanding what the heck is going on, and the number of people who are in a disenfranchised position, and being in a disenfranchised position economically or psychologically, also we know are risk factors for the advancement of conspiracy theories. It's really been a nightmare.
It is. And you know, and it's continuing, and we have to develop some skills in dealing with it, some skills in appreciating, looking inward really about what's going on, so that we can have a better, make more informed choice about how we respond to the fears that are promulgated and fears that our own brain magnifies because we're human. So we need to know something or appreciate something about this process so we're not just slaves, if you will, to our unconscious.
Isn't it interesting that in this past week, we've become aware of the presence within our own military of a certain number of people, hard to say how many it is, who themselves, who have taken an oath to defend the Constitution and to listen to their leaders, and these are people who, you know, showed up on the 6th at the Capitol, but now it turns out there actually have been members of the military, the National Guard, et cetera, who are now been excluded from today's, their presence on the Mall today because they've been identified as people who perhaps may be extremists. I mean, it's all well and good to read in the New York Times about Germany struggling with this issue, but now it turns out, well, you know what? We're fundamentally no different.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. We're talking about the psychology of conspiracy theories. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of conspiracy theories with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. If you'd like to join the conversation, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we talked about, you know, the role of fear and uncertainty. Mark, when you were talking about, you know, way back, uncertain times that you know humans lived in. So we're seeking explanations, right?
Right.
So if there isn't an explanation, is it that our brains fill in the blanks? And if it doesn't jive with the facts, how do so many people believe it to be true?
Yeah, well, that's the key that we want to look at. People believe it to be true because they automatically are looking for a pattern, for an explanation for the way something is, especially if it's bad. Because we're not made, we didn't evolve to just let things be according to chance. We didn't evolve to let things be ambivalent. We're a pattern-making species. That's the way our brain works. And that's how we survived, because our brains could make patterns, pull things together, and have an explanation and then act on that. So it's our narratives that we tell ourselves, they're just overvalued. Now, the big advantage to conspiracy theories is that it settles the fear to some degree. Because there's a target, there's a reason that is causing this that we can fight against. It's an identified target. Trump, as Jonathan was saying, was excellent at this with identifying the immigrants, the Muslims, the Mexicans, as the target for our ills. And he came at a time when there's such a huge disparity in wealth in our country, and it's only getting wider. He came at a time when there's a large segment of our population that have been left behind and don't see a road ahead of them so that they can have a better life than their parents did. That's one of the driving forces to, or one of the motivating factors to building a better life. We always want to do it. We want to be better than our parents and have our kids be better than us in certain ways. And, you know, we do measure it in terms of money and socioeconomic class that's embedded in us. And I think that's because money is power, and power is the ability to make things happen and move and make our environment the way you want it. So, It is really valued unconsciously to have an enemy identified rather than to have it just be chance or this is the way biology works, that this virus just came out of the natural world, that this is that viruses are part of. It's better to call it, like Trump did this morning, the China virus. And therefore, there's an evildoer that caused this, and we can then defend ourselves against this evildoer. The only antidote to this, we'll talk about it more, is critical thinking. And that's so hard to do because it takes a lot more energy for the brain to engage in critical thinking than it does to follow gut feelings. And
right.
Conspiracy theories are gut feelings. They speak to the gut. They infuse all perceptions stemming from the gut. That's the way our brains are built. That's the way our bodies are built. We take clues from how our gut feels, and then we find rational reasons to justify how we feel.
And we say, follow our gut, right? I want to say, follow. What does your gut say? Follow your gut. And we talked a little bit about confirmation bias, and Anne, you mentioned technology. So it's a lot easier now for us to seek out whatever our belief system may be, maybe more so than it was, decades ago.
Oh, that's absolutely true, and because of the way the technology works, as I said, we seem to have. Create our own little worlds. We have somebody that believes in an anti-vaccination, there's a whole world that we can go to and spend our every day listening to why this isn't right, why this is infringement on our right to freedom, why we shouldn't wear masks, why it's a hoax, and keep on getting confirmation. Every time you click on your feed, you're going to get confirmation for that. So there's a whole community built up. And that, in many cases, there are certain personalities, certain individuals who have a predisposition to believe in conspiracy theories. And usually, and again, it's the times we live in, there are a lot of times there are people that have been socially isolated, have been not achieving a level of accomplishment, who have latched on to these theories because there's no individual responsibility. If I believe that, it's the China virus, then I don't have to do anything. I have no responsibility. I don't have to wear a mask. I don't, because it's somebody, something or something outside of myself. That's the enemy that has been, concocting this evil plan. And so there's a lot of paranoia that comes with folks who have a predisposition. And one of the interesting things is a lot of times the folks that have this predisposition are already disengaged from social norms. They don't, they've never really bought in. So they're in a sense of powerlessness and oftentimes feelings of a low self-esteem. So there's personalities that may be more prone to this. And then there's the technology, and then there's the constant feeding of information to support the belief in their particular one. And as we said, conspiracy theories keep on layering on top of each other. And so it's troubling because facts are not going to change the person who believes a certain theory. You cannot go to them with facts, obviously. We've watched that. It's a deep-held belief and reinforcement constantly with technology.
Yeah, that's quite different than, for instance, the way I grew up, where you got information from certain numbers of newspapers or three channels on the TV. That was, everything was filtered through that those lenses. Now, there's no filter on the information that you can obtain and you can be exposed to. You just go in your room or you can do it privately. Be open, and anybody can express any idea that they want to. There's no such thing as an editor who chooses what makes sense to print or what makes sense to publicize. You just express. So we're having growing pains as a society from technology. It's obviously very useful, but it hurts. And conspiracy theories are one of the signs, manifestations of the pain of having this technology at our fingertips, and where everybody is able to promote whatever they see as a pattern that they want to alarm other people about. We got to do some work. We got to pay more attention to how our perceptions and our thinking processes are formed and how they're steered and distorted, really, as a habit.
It's interesting Biden has already, in the weeks running up to his inauguration today, has really made a very explicit emphasis on appointing people of science, establishing offices in which science will be in charge, almost as if to say, well, see, now we have a competition here between emphasizing science or not, which clearly has been the case. I mean, anybody who looks at the way in which various federal agencies have been dismantled over this past 4 years and compares that to what Biden is planning on establishing can see that there really has been a tug between these two ways of doing things. And any literature on current conspiracy thinking, you know, details how many people have been, let go, how many agencies have been left without personnel over these last 4 years. I mean, it's really quite remarkable.
Sure. One of the conspiracy theories that could doom the whole planet is climate change. If we remain ignorant to how that is happening, like a lot of conspiracy theorists would like, because they don't want to change. That's the other thing about the conspiracy theories. They tend to keep things, they tend to have an aim to keep things unchanged or the same because something new is threatening. So they have that characteristic in common. Climate change can be a disaster. That's just waiting to happen, as we know.
I say, luckily, most current studies show most people do believe in climate change. So, but you're right. There is a small group that you know, have a different opinion. Well, the other thing I think that complicates this is that not all conspiracy theories are wrong, right? There have been conspiracy theories that have turned out to be true. You know, John Lennon under government surveillance was one. Big Tobacco knew that, you know, cigarettes caused cancer. It was in the 1950s they started to see that kind of research. So that's the other thing. I guess, Mark, this is where that critical thinking comes in to be able to determine, you know, what could factually be a true conspiracy theory and what is just, you know, nonsense, right?
Well, some people got away with the conspiracy theories, like tobacco, Big Tobacco. They got away with it for a long time and did a lot of harm as a result. Trump got away with his conspiracy theories about everything being a hoax that wasn't complimentary to him, that wasn't applauding him. Then it's a hoax. It's the press enemy of the people. All those kind of things that he, that garbage that he spewed out over the past 4 years. Yes, you can say that conspiracy theories sometimes prove to be true, the only way you know is by critical thinking and analyzing it and doing it over the time and gathering the evidence. That takes a lot of work. Whereas it's much easier to feel and just to think that the mob killed JFK, for instance. It's just a quick solution to an otherwise chance tragedy.
And again, one of the allurements of conspiracy theory for disenfranchised individuals who are maybe marginalized is the enchantment of, I have special information that nobody else has.
Right.
And it's very alluring, and it boosts one's self-esteem to think that I know this and only a few know this, because if everyone knew this, it wouldn't be so intriguing.
Right.
And that feeds into that, those who are maybe disenfranchised from, normal average life,
right,
to think I have this special knowledge. It gives me power, and it gives me control, and it gives me belonging. And that's the other big piece of this. I belong to this special group.
Right.
And that's meeting needs. I mean, in so many ways, that's meeting some basic needs. So, how do we move away from that and find other ways for individuals to feel like they belong without and feel better about themselves, engaged? And that's going to be a process that our society and our culture has to work on.
You know, the analogy that I think of when taking what you're just saying there is addiction, and how an addictive substance, alcohol, drugs, whatever, can hijack your reward system. Well, that's what conspiracy theories do. They hijack your reward system, and you keep repeating it, just like alcoholics keep repeating the drinking, because it reinforces each time the behavior is repeated. You get a sense of relief and pleasure, or at least relief of anxiety. So every time you spout a conspiracy theory and you get somebody who shakes their head in a positive way in response, you're getting a reward. And you get addicted to that. That's an addictive process. So if that's really a true analogy, maybe there's a hint about how this can be at least steered differently. In my experience, the addictive person doesn't change until they've, quote, hit bottom. And everybody's bottom is different and consists of different things. It could be divorce. It could be loss of a job. It's a number of things. But there's some sort of negative consequence that just breaks through the denial, and that's what helps change their course. And I've seen it happen by an employer insisting that the person go in for treatment, recovery treatment, or I've seen it happen from judges sending somebody to Bridgewater for their addiction treatment, which really is had been something of a hellhole, really, in terms of what goes on there. But it changed. It got their attention in a way that other things didn't, and they couldn't maintain their denial anymore. Some people never, die with their denial on. Addictions can be fatal. I think these conspiracy theories can be fatal too. Well, it was fatal to five people 2 weeks ago.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of conspiracy theories with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to chime in, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And you had mentioned something about, normally being a leader, that sort of gets some of these conspiracy theories going. And it made me think of how many of you, do you remember Art Bell and Coast to Coast? He had an overnight radio program that was all about paranormal and government conspiracies and this sort of thing. And at this was, I think, in the 1980s, and I was doing early morning radio in Boston. And so I would drive up, and there's really not a lot on the radio. So I would be listening to these, Art Bell programs. And, it does make a little bit paranoid. Like, I'm going, okay, this kind of silly, but then I get home, I'm like, and all the commercials are like survival gear, right? And I would come and go, we need one of those hand crank radios just in case, right?
Yeah.
So you can see where it can become convincing when you do have somebody leading a group with some, what, as you're saying, this information nobody else has but me. And, you know, if it isn't for the fact that you can step back and go, wait a minute, in the light of day, you can see where people do fall for some of these conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I'll confess to having had one.
WCAI, you can get a hand crank radio.
That's right.
Yeah, I can confess to having had one, and that was believing in the Bermuda Triangle, that what was making those boats disappear. You know, I flirted with some kind of paranormal belief that that's what was happening. Anybody is subject to it. That's the point.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was thinking about what you were saying, so many people who work are in their trucks going here and there and blasting one radio station all the time. So between their stops, they're listening to someone scream about, you know, how terrible women are treating men, and it's, you know, they're going to, and then the next person comes on. So it's a constant feed for many people who are working and maybe not working at jobs that they particularly are happy about. So there's so much information, and it's so overwhelming. It's right. It's no wonder we want clear and fixed solutions and ideas. It's so much to take in.
That's right.
And I think that what you were just alluding to is a critical ingredient. I don't know about for all people who believe in conspiracy theories, but probably for a lot of people, and certainly the sort of folks who were marching on the Capitol, and that is fundamental unhappiness with one's lot in life.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that, you know, whatever the circumstances may be, a feeling that you're not getting what you're entitled to, a feeling
right.
that the system is somehow stacked against you, mm-hmm. Almost anything but actually taking personal responsibility for the circumstances in which you find yourself, but feeling that it's sort of you're not on a fair level playing field.
Right.
And the conspiracy mm-hmm. theory often will help you to understand how it's not your fault, and how you ended up in the situation that you're in.
That's yeah. right.
Right.
We got an email from Steve. He says, do you see a connection between the theory that all things on TV and other screens have a legitimacy and conspiracy theories? Not quite sure I understand the question.
Yeah, I don't think I understand that.
Yeah.
Sorry, Steve.
Well, maybe he's talking about that if in the past, if we used to say we read it in a book, or we saw it in the newspaper, we would just believe it. Maybe that's what he's referring to. If you see something on the screen, it's got to be true because it got there. Maybe that's what he's saying. And if that's the case, I would have to agree with him that, screen ideas that get transmitted have an inherent force behind them that encourages belief. I think that's that's a valid mm-hmm. characteristic of what goes on.
Yeah. So beliefs are, as we know, really powerful, and trying to persuade someone to abandon their beliefs is no easy task. Mm-hmm. You're saying, so what do we do?
Well, you can't persuade.
I think it starts with the relationship. Again, all of us know somebody probably who slips through the cracks of our own little secure, safe place that challenges, that maybe believes a conspiracy that we feel is ridiculous or harmful or dangerous. And I know that I have one situation like that, and I've had to literally avoid certain topics with that person. Just, we won't discuss that. We're not going to discuss that. But if it creeps in, because I value the relationship, I will gently challenge some of the premises, you know, something like, women are trying to, it's not the same. They're trying to back down men, make them, you know, feel completely powerless. And I said, I'm a woman and you're talking to me. Does that apply to me? Or what other women do you know? What age group are these women, the 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds? And he absolutely got flabbergasted. Sure. Just, and I wasn't trying to be mean. I was just saying, let's break this down. You're saying this huge, huge truth to yourself that you reinforce all the time. Mm-hmm. And why, but let's talk about in real life, that nice lady you know down the street, is she one of them? Yeah. You know, so I mm-hmm. think it's the relationship. We can start with the relationship. Sometimes it can't go anywhere, but sometimes we can gently move the parts around a little bit to challenge and make them stop and think for a minute.
That's right. You want to plant a seed of critical thinking, and that's what you just related there. You planted a seed of critical thinking with that man, and he listened to you. He's got a relationship, so he heard it. But you can't, you know, marshal a scientific proof and expect them to go along with it. That kind of induces a sense of shame. Nobody likes to see themselves as being stupid or dumb. You can confront somebody with some of this and saying, you know, that says to them, how could you be so stupid? You might want to feel like saying that, but that'll just stop the communication and the person will get more defensive and will just reinforce whatever conspiracy theory they're married to. So what you can do is ask some questions that just cause some kind of explanation, and you listen to the explanation. And maybe you challenge it a little bit, but very little bit, because you're stepping on thin ice with their sense of themselves and with self-esteem. So the other thing I can identify with the fear that people feel that is really under the surface of the conspiracy theories. You can identify with that. It is frightening to not have resources that you feel you need and feel you're entitled to. It's frightening, and you can empathize with that and leave it at that. Because you'd be surprised how far empathy can go without, challenging things that you know or that you have thought through critically, and the other person can't, won't do it, won't apply critical thinking. So let them be. That's the right.
So I guess the next question would be, we're talking a little about critical thinking. It isn't something that we teach in a lot of schools. So how do we teach critical thinking? How do we become critical thinkers?
Well, emphasizing science and math really, that's what those disciplines are based on, critical thinking. There are others too in the social sciences, based on data and statistics, which are, that used to be a curse word because it's so hard to understand. Engaging in those kind of endeavors that are based on scientific thinking. Also, just general education with literature. Hopefully you have a teacher that will engage your critical thinking of trying to figure out why this character did such and such or felt such and such. Same thing with history teachers. Why did this develop in society as opposed to that? Using what's called the Socratic method, you ask, how did it get that way? What went into it? We're all curious, and it can be very satisfying to think through something and come up with your own conclusion. So that's a little bit different than what some education is steered for now.
But, Mark, even as you talk about how one practices critical thinking and how one can teach it, it is work, and it does require effort. And perhaps one of the reasons why critical thinking is not universal is that not everybody really would prefer to think in that kind of objective way, to evidence and consider that perhaps themselves have biases. A lot of people, honestly, it's much easier to latch on to somebody who you admire, who you think is, you know, handsome or brilliant or whatever, and believe what they tell you.
Sure.
That is truly easier, which is probably why conspiracy theories and these kind of phenomena will have always existed and will always exist. I was really amazed to see that when Rome burned, there were people who thought that, it was intentionally done by
right.
Nero for reasons of his own. I mean, conspiracy theories have always existed, and I'm afraid we have to admit that they
will always be there. Let's squeeze in Scott, who's calling from Marston's Mills. Hi, Scott.
Yes, hi. Love the program. I'm hearing a lot of really good stuff. I want to build a little bit on what Ann said earlier about how a lot of conspiracy theorists may be people who feel marginalized, and they can feel special by being among the elite who understand, you know, stuff that most other people don't. Say that probably you four would be considered elites, and me too, because we're reasonably well educated and maybe somewhat successful in life. And I want to say that a lot of us elites, and this includes me, have engaged in snobbery at times, and had looked down upon and made fun of people who were less, let's say, mentally agile and less educated than we are. So I just want to throw that out there as something that we can all do, is check our own potential snobbery and feeling better than, bring up kindness and compassion and love for people who are not like us.
Oh, Scott, such a great way. We got like a minute left,
absolutely.
And what a great way to end the program, especially in this day and age. We need more kindness and empathy. Go ahead, Ann, what do you want
absolutely.
To say?
Absolutely. I was just going to say, and let's endorse that and live that and talk about that, so that the societal norms start shifting back to our higher selves. We have it all in us. And everyone has it in us. And I really appreciate what you just said, because that's the only way that we'll heal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ditto on that. That was very well said and right to the point. Of course, we're all human. We all have this faulty brain. And we're all, we might have some education on top of it, but it's still the human brain.
Right.
You don't have to control the behavior.
It's ditto.
Yeah, and again, before we judge people, and we don't know their circumstances. We don't know so we need to be less judgmental, as Scott said, have empathy and be kind. Scott, thank you so much for that phone call. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan, thank you all as always. Talk to you next month.
Thank you.
Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.